The Spread of Lyme Disease and the Powassan Virus and How to Protect Yourself, an encore presentation of our earlier conversation. Last year, Maine saw a record number of Lyme disease cases. The Maine CDC reported a total of 1,464 cases in the state in 2016. This despite a drought which kept the number of ticks down. Some experts believe this year could be worse. And now there are concerns about another, potentially more dangerous tick-borne infection, the Powassan virus. Two people have already been diagnosed with Powassan in Mid-Coast Maine this year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we listen back to our earlier show on Lyme, Powassan, and other vector-borne diseases. Learn how to protect yourself and your family, and what to do if you find a tick embedded in your skin. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Last year was a banner year for ticks, and unfortunately, this year is shaping up to be another one. That means more cases of Lyme disease are likely in our part of the country, as well as Powassan and other diseases carried by ticks. Today, we're going to learn what to watch for and how to avoid getting a tick bite. Joining me in our studio, Chuck Lubelzik. He is a vector ecologist with the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, and he is studying for a master's in public health at the University of New England. And Robert Smith is also with us. He's an internist with Intermed. He is also an infectious disease specialist with Maine Medical Center's Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Lab. I may have misspoken a little at the beginning of this program because it really wasn't that we've had a big tick year last year, did we, Chuck? We just had a lot of cases of Lyme disease. Didn't the drought actually make it so there might have been less than there would have been otherwise?
Yeah, the summer was very quiet for a lot of tick activity. However, the flip side of that was that the fall was really a banner season. And the adult ticks last fall were just out like a shot out of the barn. There were a lot of them.
So we can't sort of watch the weather and make assumptions of what we're going to be dealing with.
Yeah, it's kind of comfortable to think we could do that, and we thought we could. And so last year, we did actually have a lot of egg on our face. We were thinking, oh, it's going to be a slow year. We've got all this time to do all the sampling all over, and we were just completely overwhelmed by the number.
More than 1,400 cases. Rob, how many cases do you think there were that were unreported?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to know. The CDC has estimated nationally that 10 times as many cases occur as are reported. I think in Maine we're actually much closer to the mark. We tend to be pretty aware of the disease, and I think the reporting is pretty good. But certainly it's an underestimate of the number of cases of Lyme disease that we see every year.
What is someone who have Lyme disease? What are the symptoms? I know they're really varied, but are there some that are more common than others?
Yeah, I think the most important symptom, of course, is the rash that is very typical of Lyme disease, and it has the name erythema migrans because it starts as a smaller red circle and it becomes a larger red circle over a week or so. And by smaller, I mean usually it's around 2.5 inches wide when it first appears, and then if it's not recognized for what it is, by a week or so, maybe 6 or 7 inches wide. These rashes are flat. They're maybe a little itchy, but they're really not painful, and they can easily be missed because often the tick has bitten somebody in a place they don't look normally, so behind the back, behind the knee, even under the arm, different places. So when people come in with a rash, they usually weren't aware that they had a tick feeding on them, and they've just noticed this circular lesion. One of the things that's worth mentioning, we talk to residents about this every year, is that the textbook picture of the rash of Lyme disease is the more glorified version. So if you don't see the rash right away and you wait a week or 10 days and then you look at it, that's when you see the bullseye or the ring-like formation. But if you see the rashes in the first few days, it's just a homogeneous red circle or band depending on where it is on the skin.
And what about I've heard people have arthritic-like symptoms otherwise, other than the rash in the skin. How does Lyme disease make you feel, and why is it so rotten?
Well, if you look at people with early disease, about half the people have no other symptoms but the rash, and about half have other symptoms which do make them feel lousy, and that can be migratory pain in the in joints. It can be headache. It can be neck pain. So you get this whole sort of viral kind of picture that occurs with a rash, and that's all called early Lyme disease. That's in the first few weeks of Lyme disease. If the diagnosis is not made at that point, people may actually get better for a little while, and then they may come back with new presentations. And so a month or 6 weeks out from the initial infection, that's when we see typically neurologic disease such as a facial paralysis or persistent headaches that can be the sign of a Lyme meningitis, or rarely, fortunately quite rarely, a cardiac condition, a heart block, where people get dizzy. And when you do the EKG, you see that they actually don't have a normal conduction system in their heart. So those things usually occur in 4 to 6 weeks. And then if you go out even longer, then that's when the classic Lyme arthritis appears. And typically, that's a big boggy knee. So it's usually a large joint, often more swollen than painful. Again, it can be migratory. It can move from one joint to another. Knees are the most commonly affected, but it can involve a number of different joints.
Hmm. And if it's going to happen later, you probably – the rash is long gone by then, right?
The rash will be long gone. And usually these are people who didn't see the rash, obviously, in the summer. So the more typical scenario is we see somebody in the fall come in with a swollen knee that's not otherwise explained. It's a bit inflamed and warm. And if you tap it and look at the cells, it's clearly an inflammatory arthritis. And that's the typical scenario for Lyme arthritis.
Mm. Chuck, I've interviewed you so many times over the years, and I remember a few years ago when it was we've tracked the spread of Lyme disease, and we've tracked it up Maine's rivers and along its deer herds and things like that. And it was just a few years ago that was the first year it was in every county in Maine. What are we looking at now? Do we assume that everywhere in Maine ticks have Lyme disease?
Yeah, I think the Maine CDC would consider any county in Maine to be at risk. But I think the risk is generally a lot greater as you get southerly and towards the west. So even though we might have kind of what we call tick fatigue in Cumberland and York County, people are just so used to seeing these ticks, they don't bother really recording them or sending them into their physicians or veterinarians anymore. The ticks are still present, probably heaviest in southwestern Maine. But also the mid-coast is definitely heating up. Areas around Augusta are heating up. We've actually found ticks around areas in Somerset County, areas like the Forks for the first time last year, and areas around Machias where they're getting established. So they're definitely moving, and the range in Maine is expanding.
You talk about tick fatigue and people not sending them in. I'm guilty of that. Just this week, my dog had two ticks, and I took the tick spoon you provided me. I flushed it down the toilet. Should I have sent it in to you?
Well, actually, the University of Maine is taking over our program that we used to have at Maine Med. So they are still accepting ticks free from the Maine public. And so, yeah, sure. I think it's good, though, for people to keep up on it, because I think they're in areas where people aren't sending it in, we kind of forget. We have very short-term memory about this sometimes. So,
all right. So we'll find some information and put it on our Facebook page about how to send your tick into the University of Maine. I want to talk about Powassan. You did a lot of work the last year and a half on this. I'll start with you, Dr. Smith. What is Powassan virus? We heard, unfortunately, when Marilyn Snow died in 2013, beautiful watercolor artist on the Midcoast, really shocking to people. But now this is something that's not an unusual thing, is it?
Well, fortunately, it's still a rare for one to get Powassan encephalitis, which is a brain infection with this virus, is very rare. We've seen about one case per year in Maine over the last few years. This virus has actually been was discovered back in the 90s, and in the deer tick version of it was discovered in the 90s. And there was Powassan is actually named for Powassan, Ontario, because the first cases go back to the 50s, but then it was seen as a disease of the woodchuck tick. So there's only one way to get this, and it was not an easy way to get a disease because woodchuck ticks are rarely encountered. But then in the around 2000, we had three or four cases in Maine and Vermont, and it sort of got our attention, and we wondered whether it's possible that we would start seeing this from deer ticks. And then there was a long gap where we didn't really see any Powassan until the case a few years ago. And then the last couple of years, there's been one a year. These patients, when they have it, come in very ill with neurologic symptoms from this brain infection, and there's really no treatment for it. It's a puzzle as to why it is so rare in some ways, because we can find it in ticks maybe 1 to 2% of the time. But it seems that It's either rarely transmitted, or when it is transmitted, most of the time it doesn't cause any problem.
Okay, and turning to you, Chuck, you spent about a year and a half tracking the actual, not the cases as the Maine CDC might do, not the cases of people with it, but instead the ticks that had the virus. And what did you find?
Yeah, so we went out and tried to get as close as we could to a statewide survey. And this was actually very, very luckily we were able to get this funded through the Maine Outdoor Heritage Fund with the help of our state veterinarian, Dr. Michelle Walsh. And we were able to sample across every county in Maine, or close to every county in Maine. And we did find that in select areas, there were samples of ticks that were positive. Coastal York County, coastal Cumberland County, areas in the Midcoast, in Knox County, and then a lone outlier up in the Mount Desert Island area as well, indicating that, you know, this infection is present in the ticks, which you would expect given that we've had human cases. The one thing for us that was apparent is that we did see definite infection in adult ticks, which are out in the fall, which I think a lot of the classic education about the risk of getting ticks is in the summertime for Lyme disease, anaplasmosis. But a lot of our recent human cases have been fall acquired, happening in October or November. And certainly with adult ticks having this virus present in them, it does mean that people should really be aware in the fall and not to disregard any ticks that they find on themselves.
So if someone finds a tick on his or herself, has been gardening, goes on a walk and finds a tick and removes it, Dr. Smith, should that person be concerned?
Well, it's usually our dogma has been it's the tick you don't find that's more dangerous for you than the tick that you find. So I think that if the tick has been feeding for a while and it's a fat tick, then you do have to be concerned it's been on long enough to transmit certainly Lyme disease, which we think takes about 36 to 48 hours or something like that to be transmitted to people. Unfortunately, some of these other diseases that the ticks carry that we're learning more about probably don't always take so long to be transmitted. And certainly that probably is the case with Powassan virus, although that's based on some animal data. So the issue of concern is, well, let's say you do pick a tick that's been partially fed off of you, what's the likelihood you're going to get ill? And we know that best for Lyme disease from some studies that were done in Westchester County, that basically on the tick you remove, it's about a 3% chance that you'll get Lyme disease. And if you there's some interventions that can be done by taking a dose of an antibiotic, you can lower that to a 0.5%. But it's interesting because about half the ticks may be infected, and yet actually they're able to transmit the infection to a much smaller number of people when they bite you. There are other things that the ticks carry that we're getting interested in, anaplasmosis and babesiosis, and along with Powassan and another kind of Borrelia. And they're occurring at substantially lower numbers than Lyme disease. So I think the key thing is to be aware when you've been in a tick territory and you've found ticks on yourself, to look for others and then to just be aware of the fact that if you get ill in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's possible this is a tick-borne infection. And it could be one of several types. And so it's important to get things checked out and just not assume you've got some viral infection.
Chuck, we've been talking about Lyme and Powassan. Are we still concerned about Triple E and other vector-borne diseases in Maine?
Yeah, I think the mosquito stuff is still very important. You know, we've had 2 cases of Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus in the last 4 years, and also 2 cases of West Nile virus in humans in the last 5 years. And one of those cases of Triple E was actually a fatality from coastal York County. So it is certainly present, and it is something that really that folks should be aware of. The one thing about the mosquito issue is that these diseases, at least the ones we have here, really tend to ramp up late summer. So those early mosquitoes that we see in late May, June, early July, more of a nuisance than a public health issue. However, as the summer wears on, that's when you start to see Eastern or West Nile appear.
Why is that?
It takes a while for the virus to ramp up in nature, and initially this is cycling in mosquitoes that feed just on birds. We have a whole other class of mosquitoes that like to feed on birds and mammals like us. So they then take it out of the bird population, pick it up, and then bring it into our realm or the realm of livestock and bring it into the mammal world where you have these outbreaks occur. And that usually tends to spike towards the end of August, early September, and can last into October if it's a mild or warm fall.
Every year when we do this program, we give the same advice, and you guys can tell me if the advice has been updated at all, which is wear light-colored clothing so that you can find ticks. Use a good deterrent repellent with DEET. Check yourself. Tuck your pants into your socks. Dr. Smith, do those things work? If people really do this, are they not going to be bit?
They ought to work, but it's been very hard to show this. So when public health researchers look at different interventions that we advise to lower your risk of these tick-borne diseases, it's been very frustrating to actually prove the value. But it is there are some studies that show that tick checks, for example, or showering soon after you've been out in the tick territory and getting the ticks off in some studies have worked and other studies have not. I think it makes sense that doing things that keep ticks off of you, like using insect repellents or particularly on the lower parts of the clothing, the cuffs of the pants and things, areas where ticks are first going to attach. Those all make sense to me, but it's been very difficult to actually show how effective they are.
Mm. And I think we've generally given up on the style choice of the early 80s, pulling your socks up over the cuff of your pants. That's generally not being done anymore because most people just don't do it. It doesn't fit, and a lot of people just won't work it. So when we go outside working in the field, we do have high boots that we wear, which are, you know, you can find those pretty readily. We do rely on permethrin, a compound that goes just on clothing, and it works for several wash cycles. You apply it to a can, will treat a couple of pairs of pants, some shirts, and it works fairly well to keep the ticks off of your clothing as long as you let it dry for 24 hours. Then you can wear that stuff out in the field, and it works pretty effectively, I think, to keep them off.
Where does one find ticks? Are you more likely to find that tick when you go on a walk in the woods or when you're out clearing brush on your property?
It depends on the tick. So we have two that are the most common, dog ticks and the ones we call black-legged or deer ticks. Deer ticks tend to be creatures of, we kind of call it the Goldilocks syndrome. You know, they don't like it too hot or too cold or too wet or too dry. They tend to be found in brushy areas where there's a lot of forested shade. So it's protective from wind and sun. If you have a shady area with a lot of brush, some damp areas nearby, that's generally good deer tick habitat. Dog ticks, on the flip side, are very resistant to drying out. So you can find those in open grassy meadows. When people this time of year go out in a grassy area with a lot of wind and sun and they find 60 to 80 ticks on them in under 5 minutes, those are going to be dog ticks. They're there in hyperabundant numbers early in the spring, but they have a short season and they taper out by August or so.
So actually going on a walk in the woods is one of your least likely places to find them.
As long as you're sticking to the trails. You know, the issue with trails sometimes, though, is the ticks are sometimes on the edge. And so people stay on trails all the time. Dogs that you're walking, however, might not. So certainly, you know, be aware of the trail edge. It's going to be an area where you can encounter ticks, especially if you're out walking your dog.
Okay, well, we do have to take a break already. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, ticks, Lyme disease, and powassan. What can be done to protect yourself? Joining me today, two experts from Maine Medical Center's Vector-Borne Disease Lab. Dr. Rob Smith is an infectious disease specialist, and Chuck Lubelzik is a vector ecologist. We'll start in Blue Hill with Chrissy. Hi, Chrissy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks. I'm the outreach director for the Blue Hill Heritage Trust, and I can probably speak for a lot of us land trust folks in the state when I say this is an increasingly serious issue for us. We're always encouraging folks to get outside and enjoy nature and, you know, take advantage of all of that stuff. And with Lyme disease being so prevalent and ticks, we're having a hard time, deciding between the benefits of being outside versus protecting ourselves. And we're finding even some of the field trips we schedule with local schools end up having really low attendance on that day because parents are really scared. And I'm one of those parents. My daughter woke up with 3 ticks on her the other day, and I was not happy about that. So I'm just curious to know what your guests have to suggest to us land trust folks as good resources. And I'll also say Chuck is going to be joining us here in Blue Hill in a couple of weeks along with Griffin Dill. We're going to have a public talk on this very subject at the Consolidated School on May 18th, and that's open to the public.
Sure. I think it's a really good point you bring up, Chrissy, because all of us are really excited for summer and want to be outdoors. And Chuck, you spend all your time outdoors. You are in the thick of it, as they will. What advice do you have for folks who want to get outside?
I think dressing appropriately is the big thing. And I know a lot of people will say, oh, it's hot in the summertime, I have to wear shorts. You know, but there's a lot of tropic weight fabric that you can wear if you're going out to do any kind of outdoor activity. You know, these travel weight pants, shirts, that aren't that much hotter than wearing a pair of shorts. Any small thin layer of fabric will prevent ticks from biting you. For the landscape, if you're managing, I think land trusts have a particularly difficult time because they have sometimes a lot of acreage to cover. And there are probably core things they can do. They should really try to find out where the biggest tick exposure is, because they might not need to waste a lot of resources covering every square inch of their properties. There might be core areas on those parcels that are going to be high tick exposure.
How did they figure that out?
Well, they could go out. They could actually get reports from people going out on the trails, finding out where people are picking up ticks. They have our high-tech method. They can copy. They take a cloth and drag it through the woods and just find out where the ticks might be on their properties. And they'll probably find that there are areas that are going to be hotter than others. Once they delineate those areas, there are things like widening their trails, removing within, you know, ecological parameters, removing the brush or altering the habitat to make it unfavorable to ticks. There are other management strategies, like, you know, they can apply some kind of chemical, possibly to reduce or repel ticks, but then also doing things like wood chip borders that will kind of act as a behavioral modification. You know, people don't go beyond the wood chips or the wood chip border on a trail. That also, though, makes it an area that the ticks don't like to crawl over. So it's a very dry, open, exposed surface they have to cross to get onto the trail in the first place. So there's a lot of stuff folks can do. I would say that anybody that's doing land management, the Tick Management Handbook, which is published by the Connecticut Agriculture Station, is a very good document to download. It has a lot of sort of landscape modification strategies that people can do, either around homes or expanding that to like municipal or public access properties, trails, town forests, town parks.
Chrissy, thanks so much for your call. Good question. This is an email from Robert at Acadia Horticultural Services. I caught Lyme disease a few years ago. It was terrible. At the time, I did some research and read that a vaccine for Lyme was developed in 1990, but it wasn't released because, quote, there wasn't enough demand. Is this true? If so, why is this not available now? I would have happily been vaccinated to avoid what I went through.
That's a very good question, and we were actually involved in testing one of the two Lyme vaccines that were released and actually were approved and released and marketed for a few years, and they worked. The data on the Lyme vaccine that we were involved in suggested about an 80% level of protection, and the data safety monitoring people that were looking for adverse effects from the vaccine didn't really see any problems popping up with it. This was a huge study when it was done, I think, with 10,000 people in areas where Lyme disease was a problem. So why don't we have a vaccine? Well, it was out there for about 3 years. Sales were not great. One of the problems was that it would require boosting, and it wasn't clear what the boosting interval would be. Another problem was it was a fairly costly vaccine initially when it came out. And the public health community was fairly lukewarm about it at the time in terms of waiting to see how well accepted it would be. But the real problem was that some people became convinced that the Lyme disease vaccine was actually causing them to have Lyme disease sorts of symptoms, and this led to a legal reaction from – I think there was actually a class action lawsuit launched against the manufacturer, and they decided that the vaccine was not selling that well and that they were getting into more difficulty in terms of where they were putting their efforts than it was worth for this. And that's really cooled the interest, I think, in the commercial side in the United States for coming back with a new vaccine. There was an attempt to get something going in Europe and got fairly far along, but was then abandoned as well. And my understanding is, though, that a similar vaccine may be on the horizon to be reintroduced. So I'm hopeful that we actually will have another chance to provide a Lyme vaccine for people who are at risk. I think actually was a very cleverly designed vaccine, and I think it would have been a public health a benefit.
Sure, because this is 20 or 30 years ago when Lyme was not nearly as prevalent
exactly,
as it is
right,
today. So
right.
the whole calculation is different
sure.
now, isn't
yep.
it? Yeah. So this is Hank on Facebook. It's a long post. I'm going to read most of it. I want to challenge the recommendation by using repellents and tick checks after you've been outdoors. You can avoid being bitten. Ticks climb on the highest available weed stock and then wait for a passing animal to grab onto. I don't believe they'll pass up a rare chance due to a bad smell. I've watched ticks crawl right through a repellent-soaked area with no hesitation. I'm in and out of the house so often I cannot possibly keep myself sufficiently soaked in repellent. I have yet to hear a good scientific description that convinces me these repellents will actually do what they need as far as ticks are concerned. Regarding tick checks, have you seen the smallest size of ticks? There's no way we'll find them once they're exploring a human body. So I hope your guests will discuss the specifics of the repellent tick check approach for those of us who live in rural areas where every trip out the front door is a potential tick encounter.
So starting off with animals, one thing, dogs and cats are both vehicles to come into a house, and they can certainly bring them in and drop them on couches, beds, dog beds. Treating dog beds, or if there's a dog blanket or a cat blanket, you can treat that with repellents as well. The permethrin will actually work on a dog bed fairly well. So when the dog comes in, jumps down on the bed, ticks maybe crawl off the dog, get onto the dog bed, and the permethrin will actually repel or kill the ticks on that fabric. This is the same compound you treat your clothes with. So again, if you have a particular set of field clothes, like my Carhartts, that's what I would treat. And you wear those, and I pretty much wear Carhartts a lot when we go out in the field, and that's kind of my go-to uniform. So they're always treated. And the permethrin actually works to also kill ticks that come into contact with it. The one thing about permethrin, it will not adhere to rubber boots. However, fabric boots or leather boots like your bean boots or muck boots that have neoprene, it actually will adhere. And will stay, like I said, for several wash cycles or through several rain cycles. So if you have your kind of your go-to clothes to wear when you're going outside gardening, hunting, hiking, fishing, whatever, you know, that's going to really be the stuff that you have to treat with permethrin. The rest of the stuff, the DEET, it's like a common, it's like your sunscreen. You just have to reapply it. And DEET will wash off or sweat off after a certain amount of time. So there is a reapplication that's going to be needed for that.
So, Chuck, using yourself as a sample, when you wear your permethrin-treated clothing, have you ever been bit?
I have. You know, honestly, the first time I ever got bitten seriously and then came down with Lyme disease, it's because I was hanging a mosquito trap on the way home from work. I had changed because it was 80-degree weather. I was wearing shorts and Tevas. And I ran out of the car into the woods with a mosquito trap, hung it thinking, oh, I'm out here for under a minute. And I just ran back in the car, drove home, and then got a tick, found the tick like 2 days later when it engorged. Usually, I do tend to find the ticks crawling, or I'll find them just as they are just getting on. So I've only had Lyme once, actually.
Only had Lyme once, but yeah. But was not when you were wearing your permethrin-treated clothing.
That's right.
Okay. Yep. The follow-up, and this is the end of Hank's Facebook post. Given the healthcare crisis presented by ticks and their vectoring potential for so many really serious diseases, is there any ecological reason not to simply wipe them out entirely? I'm not talking pesticides here because that will affect other species as well, but rather some kind of genetic modification that will eliminate ticks and only ticks. I'm an ecologist. I propose this idea very cautiously and would love to hear from some experts whether this approach is viable.
No one has yet proposed releasing sterile ticks, I don't think. Has anyone ever proposed?
No, not that I know of.
You know, really, when we're talking about ticks on the landscape, one of the biggest things at the landscape level you can do is reduce the hosts or reduce exposure to the hosts that the ticks would normally feed on. In this case, for deer ticks, you're talking about white-tailed deer. And so there is probably a need in some areas for white-tailed deer management, either removal, eradication, or reduction to perhaps deal with a tick problem.
We'll go to Ward, who's calling from Gardner. Hi, Ward. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
His last comment just tucks into exactly my comment. Has anyone proposed hunting or sharpshooters or any way of controlling or almost eliminating the white-tailed deer, say, in the southern half where it's warmer, say, south of Route 2? If we eliminated almost all the deer, wouldn't that take care of the tick problem?
That's one of the holy grail issues for tick ecology to wrestle with. You know, we know that on certain island settings, you can reduce your deer and you can see a drop in the deer population. This gets very hard, though, in the mainland at the landscape level, because deer obviously migrate and they can move to an area where there's no hunting and then repopulate after a hunt is done. I think, though, IFNW is very cognizant of this problem, and I think this issue with deer overabundance is really being addressed when the state looks at its deer management goals over the next decade or so.
Should be pointed out that actually in Monhegan Island was a proof of principle of that question. So on Monhegan Island, there was Lyme disease, and deer had been introduced in the 50s, and for various reasons, the deer were becoming a problem on the island. And after trying a number of different less draconian approaches, the island population voted to have the deer removed. And we were involved in research on the island at the time. And as we watched the tick population over the next 2 to 3 years, we saw the disappearance of the black-legged tick. But it took actually the first year after the deer removed, there were more ticks around because there were probably fewer animals for them to attach to. But if you waited 2 to 3 years, then they actually were no longer there. Obviously, this is not applicable to almost anywhere else because the island was far enough out that it couldn't be repopulated.
That's right. Deer can swim to islands that are closer to shore.
And they were not native to the island as well. And it was still a very difficult decision, but it did prove the role of deer, the importance of deer in the cycle.
Ward, thanks for your call. We're going to go down to Heather Hurst. She's founder and CEO of Project Lyme. Hi, Heather.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Thank you for doing this program.
Sure. Tell us what Project Lyme is and why you started it.
So Project Lyme is a national nonprofit headquartered here in Rockport, Maine, and we're focused on awareness and education for Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses.
And what are the biggest misconceptions that you think people have about Lyme disease?
Well, there's quite a few, but since we're a national organization, I'm talking on a national level where there's tick-borne illness everywhere, one of the biggest misconceptions is that it's easy to diagnose and easy to treat, and that is not always the case. I mean, it is. Dr. Smith was speaking earlier about the bullseye and catching it early here in Maine, and that does happen here quite often, but the disease is spreading throughout the country, and it is often missed, and often then it becomes more difficult to diagnose, and I have seen so many severely ill people because they miss the early signs and symptoms, and they're really struggling because it's hard to treat once we get past the early stages.
All right. Well, Heather Hurst is founder and CEO of Project Lyme, and Heather, we'll put a link to your organization on our Maine Calling Facebook page. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you, and thanks for joining the program.
Yep. We do have to go to another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, avoiding ticks and the diseases they carry. Joining me today, two tick experts, both of Maine Medical Center's Vector-Borne Disease Lab. Chuck Lubelzik is a vector ecologist with the lab, and Dr. Rob Smith is a physician and researcher. Dr. Smith, before we go back to the calls, we've talked about Triple E, Lyme, Powassan. I think you briefly brought up anaplasma. What is that? Is that also a tick-borne disease?
Yes. So right after Lyme, there were 1,400 cases of Lyme disease reported last year in Maine, and there were 300 cases of anaplasma, which was only discovered in the late 1990s or around 1994 or 5 as a pathogen. It's carried by the same tick, so it's carried by deer ticks. And maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we were seeing 30 to 40 cases a year, or at least that were being reported, and now that's 300. So some of that is increased recognition. Physicians are getting much more aware of this tick-borne disease and checking people for it. The other thing is it presents very nonspecifically. So unlike a Lyme disease, which commonly has the rash, anaplasmosis presents simply as a high fever, headache, aches, and nothing else is really very specific. Most people, young people and people who don't have serious illnesses, if they get it, they may not become ill at all. But for older people or people who have other medical problems, it can become a very serious infection that comes on quite quickly. So the key thing with that is that some simple blood tests in the doctor's office or the emergency room can be a tip-off to the likelihood of this disease, and it can be diagnosed quite readily, again, with some other blood tests that are available. And the good news is it can be treated very effectively with doxycycline, which is what we use to treat most cases of Lyme disease. So there's a good side to it. It just has to be recognized. And I should just mention there's another disease that we're seeing more of called babesiosis, used to be called Nantucket fever, or was first recognized back in the 70s as a malaria-like illness. So also presents with fever, sort of non-specific kinds of symptoms. And you just need to be aware of it if you have those kinds of symptoms and other tests are negative. So we're trying to increase awareness about the whole panoply of pathogens that we see from this tick.
Take them seriously.
Yes.
Email from David. We have free-range layer hens. How effective are they in reducing the tick population?
So I think that this is one of the few instances where we have kind of an urban legend about ticks. So there's a lot of anecdotal data out there that says that in parts of the country, chickens or guinea fowl will actually control ticks because chickens roam around, they scratch, they eat a lot of insects. And I think down south, where you have much larger ticks, like a tick called the Lone Star tick, that's fairly noticeable and big and fairly fast-moving, ticks probably see that and eat them. However, there really hasn't been a whole lot of science behind this. And so this is one of those studies that is just begging to be done by some future graduate student that likes chickens. You know, it's a real study that needs to be done to see if they actually do work. The jury's kind of out on whether or not they actually effectively take ticks off your property in big numbers. Deer ticks are so small in the summertime that it might be a little hard for chickens to maybe see them.
And they're not in the ground where the chickens are scratching.
That's true.
Okay. So we're going to go to Neil, who's calling from Swan's Island. Hi, Neil. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 73, and I'm experiencing the aftermath of 6 weeks of doxycycline. And, my advice is that it took too long to diagnose this. And the Western blot test is the blood test, but it's more expensive. I guess it's not routine, but I think it should be. And I know that there's a lab in California that will tell you even in greater detail, but it's expensive. So, my reason for the call is that it's a pretty, dreadful experience, but once you're over it, I'm not going to change what I do. I'm going to still be outside, and, I never saw a tick or a circle or a target, and as far as rashes go, you have to resist scratching them because that's what makes them kind of flower. That's my comment.
Neil, thanks for calling, and I'm so sorry. Dr. Smith, tell us about the testing for Lyme and why some tests are favored over others. Aren't there some who give false positives and false negatives?
Well, any test you do for an infectious disease has some level of false positives and some level of false negatives. And so every test is looked at in the clinical context in which you're using it. So for the Lyme disease testing, I think there are a couple of key points. One is don't rely on the tests for early Lyme disease. So the current tests are antibody tests. They detect your reaction to the infection, but the development of that reaction takes several weeks. So if you come in with a rash or you come in with acute fever and other symptoms and you rely on the blood test to tell you whether you have Lyme disease or not, you'll miss it half the time because the tests are not that sensitive early on. Once you're beyond the first few weeks, and let's say 4 to 5 to 6 weeks, if you have undiagnosed Lyme disease and you have active and symptoms from it, then the tests are much more helpful. So the sensitivity or the likelihood they'll pick up Lyme disease is going to be in the 80 to 90% range. The caller asked about Western blots. That's one sort of standard technical approach to making the diagnosis. Actually, it looks like there are other more reproducible tests that are on the horizon that may actually replace Western blots, which tend to have a little more subjectivity to them. So there's a very active research effort going on right now in trying to improve Lyme disease testing, particularly for early Lyme disease, but also to make it simpler to interpret and faster to get the result.
Neil, thank you for calling in. We're going to go to Judy, who's calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I just thought people would be interested. I found a tick on my cat in the first week of March when it was still, gosh, I think in the 20s outdoors at night, and there was an awful lot of thick snow on the ground. And I was very alarmed by this. I think from what I've heard your guests say, I realize now this may have been a dog tick, but I wondered if your guests could comment on sort of the conditions, how cold, the kind of cold that ticks can withstand, because I just was dumbfounded to find it on her so early. I also wondered if they could talk a little bit more about that chemical that you can put on your clothes.
Permethrin? Yeah.
Where to buy it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the permethrin question is easy. A lot of outdoor supply places will carry it. L.L. Bean's, Cabela's, big box stores, you know, your Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, will all have a version of it. And just look on the can. The active ingredient will be permethrin. And it comes in a pretty standardized concentration, so there's not a lot of variability about that. But about the winters, yeah, generally ticks are going to be active, and really when it gets above an average daily temp of 40 degrees or so. So you can certainly still have ticks out when there's snow, but you're going to have some areas nearby that are going to have bare ground. And though that bare ground, your cat or your dog or your person might go on it and might encounter ticks there. But certainly we've had years where the ticks have been active as early as late February when we've had mild spring. So early March is not uncommon. And this year especially, they were out that early in some parts of the state.
And I know you have told me in the past that they love to hide under the snow. They're just waiting for it to melt.
They do, yeah. The snow's a nice insulating blanket for them. So our traditional old New England winters, it can be very beneficial to them, even if we have a really cold, cold spot go through.
We'll go to Marie, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Hi, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to comment on an earlier recommendation in the show for spraying cat and dog beds with permethrin insecticides as a tick control measure. And it's really important to note that permethrins are very toxic to cats. It's a neurological toxin. And they in fact can die from exposure to permethrins. Even a dog bed that a cat uses occasionally should not be sprayed with a permethrin insecticide.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. Have you heard this, Chuck?
Yeah, it's when the permethrin is wet that it is cats are most highly susceptible. And in general, I think when the permethrin is allowed to dry for about 24 hours and it's in in the fabric, it then becomes not an issue. So, for instance, the fabric that you would buy, your insect shield clothing, actually has permethrin impregnated into the fabric at the factory. And once it gets to your door, however, it's thoroughly dried and is kind of rendered in that capacity inert. So your cat, for instance, could crawl on your dried, treated Carhartts.
So probably a good idea for all of us to make sure it's really good and dry, though.
And it's most effective then, too, so it doesn't run off.
Okay, great. We'll go to Topsom and Brenda. Hi, Brenda. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
I have a question for pets. What do they recommend to put on pets to prevent ticks getting on them? I have two dogs, and one of them I give Bravecto to. The other one takes Vectra because she won't take a chew pill. However, the Vectra affects her quite badly. For 2 weeks, she just rolls on the floor and scratches her back. And I know that some of those things that you put on the pets can make them really sick. And I wondered if there's any one in particular that's good to you.
Thanks, Brenda. I know you're not a veterinarian.
No, I'm not a veterinarian. No, I think that it depends on the animal. So certainly the stuff that's available for cats is a lot different in some cases than the stuff available for dogs. And in many ways, there's a wider range of products you can actually apply. So for instance, there is a compound that actually has permethrin that you can put in the dog's fur, for instance, that will kill the ticks on it that you can apply. There are certain compounds, fipronil-based. Frontline was one for a number of years that worked on both cats and dogs. My understanding is Frontline is being kind of phased out because it's no longer effective against fleas anymore, however, still effective against ticks. NexGard is another one that I know is on the market right now that's very popular with vets. It's a couple of years old that does tend to be widely used.
All right, Brenda, thanks for your call. We'll go up to Belfast and Mary Ann. Hi, Mary Ann. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for the program. I'm wondering about the persistence of symptoms after treatment. If you pull a tick off, I had this happen, and it's not engorged, and you go immediately up and get the treatment at the hospital, does the bullseye and the other symptoms on the skin continue on after that, or should that take care of the symptoms like widening, you know, red areas, et cetera?
Well, I think there are two issues there. One is that should you do something about a tick bite? So you find the tick that's been partially fed, and there is the option if it's a deer tick, and if it's been feeding, and if it's been removed within 72 hours. Those are the conditions under which the study was done. Then for adults and for non-pregnant women, there is the option of taking a single dose of doxycycline. It's 200 milligrams of doxycycline. And in the study that I mentioned earlier, that lowered the risk of subsequent Lyme disease from, let's say, 3% to 0.5% or so. So it has a role. It's kind of limited in terms of the timing in which you get a benefit from this. So there is that. But the second question is, well, what if I actually have Lyme disease and I come in with the rash and I get treated? There was a very large study done in the upper Midwest of 600 people with early Lyme disease with the rash treated with the appropriate antibiotics. And of those 600 people who were followed over 2 years, six of them appeared to have failure of the antibiotic. But when they actually looked at those six, one of them had gotten an antibiotic that wasn't effective. One of them had actually developed a complication in the first few days of treatment that wasn't attributable to Lyme disease. And the other four had actually evidenced they'd been reinfected the second summer. So two things came out of that study. One, treatment is very effective in early Lyme disease if it's the appropriate treatment. Number two, the fact that you got Lyme disease once doesn't mean you can't get it again, so that you do need to be careful the next summer.
Marianne, thanks for your call. A Facebook post from Leslie. Can essential oils repel ticks, such as rose, geranium, and others?
There is a lot of work that needs to be done on the botanical front. About 10 years ago, we had a couple of products on the market that worked really well to either control or suppress or repel ticks that were botanical sprays. And those have since gone off market. And some recent work out of the University of Rhode Island indicates that a lot of botanicals are not as effective, unfortunately, as some of the synthetics are. And so there probably is some efficacy in applying botanicals. The problem is formulation, how these oils are extracted, concentration, what are they mixed with? Is it rosemary and wintergreen or just rosemary? Because they can have alternate effects if you have a mixture. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area. And it's sort of like the new frontier for a lot of tick control work would be this botanical area.
Yeah, and a similar question from Martha by email. How effective are all natural products that don't have DEET? And is it safer to expose oneself or young children to DEET or to these less toxic and maybe ineffective natural products? The ticks, bites causing Lyme disease or Powassan may be far worse than DEET. It's something a lot of people are balancing. You've used permethrin as what you've done instead.
Yeah, and a lot of the science behind the DEET issue is that 28% concentration of DEET is as effective as 100% when it comes to application. So you don't really need to go above 28% concentration for your DEET spray.
Okay, well, there's so many people. We couldn't get to your questions, and I apologize for that. But we will put some resources on our Facebook page. I've already put the tick identification resource from the University of Rhode Island there, and we'll add some others. Thank you guys both for being here. Dr. Rob Smith, internist with InterMed, infectious disease specialist with Maine Medical Center's Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Lab, and Chuck Lubelzik, a vector ecologist with Maine Medical Center Research Institute. John Keimel ran the board today. Sam Dearen answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.